Welcome to Leo Roundtable at leoroundtable.com. My name is Chip DeBlock, and I'm your host, and we're a group of law enforcement professionals that talk about today's news and issues, but we do it from a law enforcement perspective. And let me introduce the crew. Guys, if you don't mind waiting for the video portion of our show, he's back, Chief Joel Schultz. And he's a huge writer for Police One. We've been covering this stuff for years, and we finally grabbed on to him, and we have him on Leo Roundtable. You can also reach him at schultzco@gmail.com. We're going to be talking about some of his books in a second. Also, Sergeant Jamie Borden, he's back as well. Critical Incident Review. He needs no introduction. And boy, I tell you, when we have Sergeant Jamie on, he can break down a use of force and dummy it down for the rest of us like nobody can. It's incredible. And he's an expert across all over the country, saving cops that get themselves in the world of hurt as well. So love having both of you guys on the show. A shout out to our sponsors, Gauls, our title sponsor at Gauls.com, Compliant Technologies, our satellite sponsor. So Gauls is our title. Compliant Technologies, thanks to them. I think that we're on our ninth week on satellite radio. If you guys can believe that, that's just incredible. Also, gunlearn.com, bluethegold.com, mymedicare.life, and Safeguard Recruiting, thanks to them, our streaming sponsor. We're reaching about 1.5 million people on stream right now. Also, twobells.com. They've built a new online store at leoroundtable.com. Check out our cool gear at leoroundtable.com and check out that online store that Two Bells built for us. A shout out to Brian Burns for the Tampa Free Press at tampafe.com. Thanks for carrying our content, Brian. Also, Ray Diedrich, former lawman.com and lawofficer.com. Thanks to all these entities for helping make the show happen. And now, the whet the appetite and what we're going to be talking about. We're starting off talking about a cop is shot in the neck outside an ICE facility in an alleged coordinated attack that happened in Texas. And then we got a backup story. Heavily armed gunman targets Border Patrol agents and gets shot dead in Texas. So Texas is not the place you're going to want to be trying to take out, you know, active law enforcement, especially our border guys. Then we've got Tish. We're talking about the commissioner in NYPD. She overrules NYPD judge, clears an officer who killed an unarmed man during a Bronx traffic stop. But there are extenuating circumstances, and we're going to hear about that. And also, Jamie's going to be adding some incredible insight into that. And then we got, we're not leaving, going anywhere. We're still at NYPD. New York lowers the minimum age for police service, and they eliminate the exam fee. And let me tell you, the age to get in was 21, and they just lowered it. So start scratching your heads and thinking about that one. And then we got a body cam video showing a stabbing suspect charging an officer with a dagger, not a knife, it's a dagger, made simply to stab someone so they can bleed out before he ends up being fatally shot. And then we got a Kern County Sheriff deputy shooting a man that's wielding a rifle on top of a roof, and the rifleman gets taken out by the gunman with a pistol. That's pretty impressive. Then we got Oklahoma City police release footage showing what led up to a deadly shooting of a rape suspect, and then double stabbing an arson suspect fatally shot by Prince George deputies. So that's the lineup, and we're going to take those in order unless you guys want to move anything around. But, you know, starting off, RVMnews.com, which stands for Red Voice Media, cop shot in the neck outside an ICE facility, an alleged coordinated attack in Texas. I'm going to cover both of these back to back, and then we'll discuss them if that's okay. A police officer in Alvarado, Texas, was shot late on Thursday night during a coordinated attack outside the Prairie Land Immigration and Customs Enforcement Detention Facility. Now, according to the Alvarado Police Department, it starts about 11 o'clock p.m. Officers respond to a report of a suspicious person there near this federal facility. When police get there, they encounter what appears to be an armed individual. So as an officer is attempting to engage this guy, multiple suspects allegedly open fire and strike the officer in the neck. So multiple suspects open fire. Crazy, right? The officer is airlifted to a hospital in Fort Worth for emergency treatment. It goes on to say that Alvarado police confirmed on Friday that the officer was treated, later released. His identity has not been disclosed. And officials said that several suspects attempted to flee the scene. They were quickly apprehended with help from the Johnson County Sheriff's Office. And a federal source told CBS News that eight individuals were taken into custody, and they were reportedly wearing body armor. The story just gets better and better. Preliminary reports indicate the attack may have been premeditated. According to CBS News, more than a dozen masked individuals dressed in black arrived at the ICE facility late on Thursday. They allegedly vandalized vehicles and surveillance equipment. They were launching fireworks. They think that maybe that was a diversion to lure the officers into an ambush situation, and local and federal authorities are continuing to investigate their circumstances surrounding that incident. And then we jump to our next one. Heavily armed gunman targets the Border Patrol agents and gets shot dead in Texas. So this gunman, he's wearing tac gear. He's armed with a rifle, open fires on U.S. Border Patrol agents outside a Border Patrol annex facility. This one's in McAllen, Texas, and this happened on Monday. And the shooting happened at a facility in the Rio Grande Valley sector. Border Patrol agents and local law enforcement, they returned fire. They killed the bad guy. And one officer with the McAllen Police Department, he ended up being struck by gunfire. He was transported to a local hospital. He's in stable condition. And the FBI is investigating that one. And it goes on to say, finally, that law enforcement officials believe the gunman specifically targeted Border Patrol agents in what is being described as a deliberate ambush. So, you know, you hate to cover this crap, but this is what's going on. This is not just one time. This is and I know right now we're dealing with the stuff going on in Texas, but oh my gosh, guys, what do you guys think about this? Sergeant Jamie, you want to start us off?
Sure. Yeah. And you know, this is the way these things are laying themselves out. And this is every day now, Chip. And what this appears to me to be is a war against the ICE movement. And, you know, these attacks are happening in coordinated fashion. That's a war, right? These guys, these Border Patrol agents are basically in a war. And this is, you know, whatever the beliefs are of individuals in the political realm, this is their way of fighting back on these decisions in ICE, it sounds like. And when you've got gunmen that are wearing TAC vests and have a coordinated attack, and this isn't happening once, but multiple times. You know, I mean, my heart goes out to these guys that are working under this environment. This is no longer police work. This is a tactical battlefield, and it's happening at their doorstep. And it's alarming, right? What does that mean for law enforcement? And I think those questions are going to be burning from now on at this point. And to see these kind of coordinated attacks on law officers, it's not a climate I think that law enforcement is used to.
Well, thanks, Sergeant. Yeah, it is scary. Dr. Schultz.
Yeah, oh, so many things to say about this and about the larger issue. You know, some of this, I think, is a real challenge to the intelligence community, because to think that this is all lone wolf, small group, independent militia stuff, probably kind of fantasy thinking. I suspect there's a thread of funding and coordination and training and those kind of things. And we've seen these militia movements, you know, on the left and on the right over time. But it's partially also psychological warfare. As Jamie mentioned, it's gonna terrorize individual police officers and individual police families to weaken local law enforcement. There's also, and I would mention, you know, in Alvarado, that's a department of like 23 officers. So this is not like, you know, LAPD or Phoenix, you know, with all kinds of resources. And there's also, I think, a very intelligent and deliberate effort to separate ICE from local law enforcement. I was listening to some anti-ICE interviews on NPR. See, it's not just Fox News. I also listen to NPR, and and they were saying, well, you know, the local cops don't like ICE either, blah blah blah, and. You know, and a lot of these big raids, people don't recognize that you may have a dozen or two dozen different federal agencies involved in what's called an ICE operation. You know, it's kind of confusing sometimes to see the banners on the raid vests where they say, you know, HSI or DEA or Fish and Wildlife, you know, whatever they have to get together. So I think it's just too advantageous to the left-wing anti-federal government movement that these things are happening both in the narratives that happen on the news and the actual terroristic type of attacks that you see in different places around the country.
And you know, and you saying that, Chief, one of the questions that comes up in my mind, especially doing expert work across the country on officers where their decision-making process is being evaluated and, you know, based on what we see in video or what the evidence produces, What are these attacks doing to local law enforcement, right? Not necessarily our federal guys, but what is this doing to their decision-making process when they are confronted with something that they are now, they're assimilating all of this information and downed officers and coordinated attacks and all these different things? How is that affecting their decision-making in something that may appear to be that, but not that? And how is that going to reveal itself in these critical incidents? And are the officers going to be held culpable for a narrative that is real? This is a real narrative that's floating around out there, and that's called experience, right? These officers are learning from these events how to respond. And like you said, a 22-man department, how much tactical training do they get? And how much do they think they even need to begin with, right? They're not focused on that. They're a small department. They probably know most of the city or the township that they are involved with by name, right? A 22-man department is not a large footprint for patrol. That's every shift, right? So those are the questions that come up in my mind, is how is this narrative going to affect the decision-making process when events appear to be these violent coordinated attacks?
And I don't think it's an accident that some of these things are preceded by use of fireworks. It is maybe a clever distraction device, but it's also going to fit into the narrative when an officer is being attacked just by a firecracker and returns fire. And then the narrative goes ballistic like it always does. You know, they were, you know, out of their mind, didn't know what they were doing and should be prosecuted.
Right. And the question becomes, what was reasonable to believe at that moment, right? When a firecracker goes off, it sounds like a gun. You smell gunpowder.
Guys, coming up on our first commercial break. Stick with us. We'll be right back. All right, guys. You know, as police officers, we know we can get our gear from a lot of different sources. And especially when we consider going online, the possibilities are almost endless, right? But I want to remind everybody about the importance of supporting the companies that actually support law enforcement. I don't know of a company that fits that bill better than Gauls at Gauls.com. Even their motto is proud to serve those who serve, which, of course, they do in spectacular fashion. And they walk the talk by supporting dozens of focused organizations like this radio show. So when you're looking for gear, please support our title sponsor by going to Gauls at Gauls.com. And they have gift cards. We're actually going to give away one today. And by simply, if you're watching the live show, type in the word Gauls, G-A-L-L-S, and give us your email address so we can send that free $50 digital Gauls gift card to you. But if you have family, friends, and loved ones, hook them up with a Gauls gift card. They'll be your new best friends. All you have to do is go to Gauls.com in order to get that done. And they pretty much have everything but guns and ammo. Again, Gauls.com. Every cop and firefighter should know that name, Gauls.com. Welcome back to Leo Roundtable at leoroundtable.com. My name is Chip the Block. I'm your host. We're joined by Chief Joel Schultz, Sergeant Jamie Borden with Critical Incident Review. We're talking about attacks on ICE, you know, near the border. And this is pretty much isolated to the Texas area right now. But it seems like it's a coordinated effort. These guys have got body armor, long guns, and they're trying to take out, you know, cops. And and actually, we've had some cops that were shot very recently involving this. And, you know, I'm surprised, Jamie, with everything that's going on, especially with the 4th of July. I have to admit, we just you know, bombed the crap out of Iran. And I'm just saying, man, if they're looking to make a statement, July the 4th is probably pretty attractive on a date to make a statement. And I think it's just imperative that every cop, whether you're active or retired, that, you know, we have LEO, the Law Enforcement Officer Safety Act, also known as HR 218. We need to carry everywhere we go. And I'm waiting for the first off-duty or retired cop to be in the right place at the wrong time. Notice I didn't say the wrong place at the wrong time. The right place at the right time where they can take out a terrorist threat like that and save the day, because they're packing and they're carrying their gun with them. I just can't wait for that day. And we're going to cover it extensively on our show, and we're going to do something for that guy.
Yeah, absolutely. It's important to exercise that right. And especially as a retired law enforcement officer, we never stop thinking like a cop, and we thinking along those lines, we see things that other people don't see. And it's important to be able to act on that. I left my house the other day. I got almost to where I was going and realized I had left my pistol on the counter. literally stopped, turned around, drove back home, was late to my appointment because I'm in complete disbelief that I forgot. It's like leaving your house without your pants on. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like it feels uncomfortable. And my hope is that I never have to use it. That's my hope. I hope no one ever sees that weapon. And but the problem with that is when you do need it will be the time that you forgot it. So just don't forget it and you'll never need it.
I see you attempted to drag Randy Sutton into this conversation by talking about leaving without wearing your pants on in your house. But other than that, I agree with everything you said.
Well, speaking of Randy, you know, I'm a big advocate for being aware of officers wounded in the line of duty. And we see these reports and it says, oh, non-life-threatening injuries and the officer was treated and released. That's no small thing. You know, you get shot in the neck. Oh yeah. Put a Band-Aid on, go back to work. No, that's going to be a cloud over your head forever. And that doesn't mean it's a matter of technical or mental weakness. It's just the brain is going to try to protect you from that ever happening again. And that can manifest itself in some healthy and unhealthy ways. So I always continue to want to know how those officers are doing. I noticed when Chief Noller was on a while back, you asked how his officers were doing from a shooting that happened like a month before. And people forget the news cycle moves on and you don't realize that these cops are still struggling with, do I go back to work? You know, what does my spouse think about all this? It's devastating.
I agree.
Go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. You hear that narrative that the officer was treated and released. It automatically paints the narrative that it was no big deal. And that's the way it's perceived. And it's quickly forgotten. Treated and released doesn't mean it's not a big deal. This person was shot. And it's, you know, you cut your finger on a butter knife. It's a big deal. You know what I mean? So, yeah, all the trauma that goes along with that. I agree with you, Chief.
Well, we've got an article. We've got two articles from New York, NYPD. Tisch overrules NYPD judge, clears officer who killed unarmed man during Bronx traffic stop. And maybe somebody can explain to me. I got to admit, I don't know. It says, does NYPD have their own judges? I don't know. But I mean, it says NYPD judge. So I was kind of curious about that. But I know they've got around 35,000 man police force, too. But it says NYPD Commissioner Jessica Tisch overruled the departmental judge's recommendation, cleared an officer who fatally shot an unarmed man during a 2019 traffic stop in the Bronx. So this has been going on for a while. This was back in 2019. This is like potentially like 6 years ago. After a departmental trial that happened last year, NYPD Judge Rosemarie Maldonado recommended firing Lieutenant Jonathan Rivera. She sided with the city's police watchdogs who said that the lieutenant needlessly shot our bad guy named Alan Felice as he tried to flee the stop. Now, the commissioner, Tisch, she disagreed. She wrote that Lieutenant Rivera and Felice, the bad guy, engaged in an intense physical struggle and that Lieutenant Rivera made a split-second decision when he believed that his fellow officer's life was in immediate risk. And so they're going to set the stage for this, and they're going to create a word picture for you guys. And if you guys don't get it, Jamie Borden is going to fix that. So in a statement, our bad guy's family said that they are completely outraged and accused Tisch, the commissioner, of prioritizing police over public accountability. Now, the lieutenant who shot the bad guy, Rivera, he was among several officers who pulled over Felice the bad guy, 31-year-old Washington Heights resident. He was not wearing a seatbelt. Officers found that he had open warrants tied to the identification of the ID that this guy provided. Our bad guy tried to drive off. The lieutenant fires a single shot into his chest and kills him. The lieutenant testified that he feared other officers might be run over because he couldn't see them during the struggle. Now, the judge, who ruled against the officer, the lieutenant, found that the explanation, it was inadequate. In her ruling, she wrote, the use of deadly force requires more than the mere possibility of danger. Now, but there's more information. Because what the judge said doesn't necessarily not make sense, right? The commissioner, Tisch, overruled the finding, saying that the car had actually lurched backward, and Lieutenant Rivera's fellow officer, Edward Barrett, he had been on the driver's side. He briefly disappeared from view when the car lurched backward. She said it was reasonable for the lieutenant to believe that the officer had been hit by the car door and then he'd fallen underneath the car. And given the bad guy's repeated unyielding efforts to move the gear shift in the drive, despite all efforts by the officers, she felt it was reasonable for the lieutenant to believe that our bad guy could continue to do so. And so it goes on to say that Attorney General Letitia James, which is no fan of law enforcement or Donald Trump for that fact, that she actually felt along the same way and actually declined to file criminal charges against the lieutenant. Since the shooting, Lieutenant Rivera was promoted to lieutenant. And I can see that I'm running out of time. I got 10 seconds. We're going to commercial break. Guys, we'll finish this up in 1 second. We'll be right back. All right, guys. Now it's time to talk about compliant technologies. In the day's world, protection goes beyond physical safety. It's about safeguarding those on the front lines from what we call hidden threats. And that's where MyTech, which is a division of compliant technologies, comes in. Now, MyTech, if you guys can mute your microphones for me, I appreciate it. MyTech provides advanced protective solutions designed for law enforcement, corrections, and first responders. Now, their Eagle Protect nitrile gloves, they offer 4-hour fentanyl and xylene protection, giving you peace of mind in high-risk environments. Plus, their MyShield disinfectants and sanitizers actually eliminate 99.9% of germs, bacteria, and viruses on contact, and they continue the kill for up to 28 days, helping you stay protected both on and off duty. So when safety is non-negotiable, you can trust MyTech to deliver the protection that you need, and you can learn more about how to equip your team today by simply going to compliantechnologies.com/MyTech. Again, that's compliantechnologies.com/MyTech, because the best defense starts with the right protection. Now let's talk about Blue the Gold at bluethegold.com. If you're struggling with the ins and outs of warrantless searches and seizures, or if you're worried about the liability in case you get it wrong, say hello to bluethegold.com. They translate search and seizure doctrines into clear, straightforward concepts that any officer can relate to. Plus, they give the training for free thanks to bluethegold.com's free weekly webinars. Now, coming up, Bulletproof DUI reports on July the 9th. You can sign up at bluethegold.com today and join thousands of your peers in blue and step up your legal game, because frankly, you and your agency cannot afford not to. Bluethegold.com. Welcome back. Leo Roundtable at leoroundtable.com. My name is Chip the Block, your host, joined by Chief Joel Schultz and Sergeant Jamie Borden from the Las Vegas area. We've been talking about a New York story. The Commissioner Tisch overrules the NYPD judge who cleared an officer who killed an unarmed man in the Bronx traffic stop. So the judge wanted them to terminate this officer. The commissioner said, nope, not going to happen. And so the commissioner went along with, believe it or not, AG Letitia James felt the same way. The lieutenant is a lieutenant because he got promoted since then. And our union president, the Lieutenant Benevolent Association president, Louis Turco, he actually is praising the chief, saying our commissioner will back officers acting in good faith and good faith performance of their duties, no matter the political risk. So I think that was that's who you want to work for, right? Someone that's going to back you, not just when you're right, because then it's easy, right? But even when it gets tough. Chief Schultz.
Yeah, I I'll talk first, because this is really Jamie's wheelhouse, and he'll have some good commentary on it. First of all, this mythology of unarmed equals no threat is a myth. Secondly, to say that, there's no accountability, you know, we've talked about this before. Local charges, state charges, federal charges, lawsuits, department, agency consequences. To say that there's no accountability, there's not. I mean, show me another profession that has a camera on them 24/7. And you may have seen the article where there was a civilian review board guy that said cops ought to have cameras on them 24 hours a day. Yeah. That's an interesting concept. And thirdly, maybe Jamie can respond to this more definitively. The people think that if a cop say, oh, I feared for my life, that that's a get out of the jail free card. No, you've got to have an articulated, reasonable fear. It's grounded in facts as the officer perceives them. It's just not, oh, I was scared, so I shot.
And this thing is multifaceted, and I want to try to capsulize it as best as possible. First of all, some really important terminology: watchdog groups. This is civilian review boards that are making recommendations, and then that ties into an outcome-based investigation, meaning the outcome, knowing in hindsight that the subject didn't have a weapon. Well, the subject had a vote in this incident. The subject could have complied, and the subject is driving a vehicle, which is a deadly weapon for an officer who is attempting to move to contact. There's a deadly weapon involved, which leads us into the next component, where there's a reasonable belief of not just danger to yourself, but danger to others, and the need to stop a threat, and a choice based on a risk versus threat assessment, the risk to officers for being there. And Chief Schultz, you that fear for my life, I've got a whole chapter of that regarding that statement in my next book that's coming out, and it's important. If officers fear for their life in the moment. It's not that they are fearing for their own life. It's that they're dealing with a deadly threat. The fear for your life comes in much later when you start to contemplate the magnitude of the event that you've been involved in. And I've experienced that. I'm speaking from experience where I ran into the gunfire, made my decisions, and then after the fact, clearly feared for my life. But at the time, I didn't. At the time, I feared for everyone else's lives and put my life in danger to stop the threat. So there's a very different narrative with that. It's never just as easy as articulating that I feared for my life. Defense attorneys will end an interview with that question. So is it safe to say, officer, that when you fired your shot, you feared for your life? And that becomes a blanket excuse. And that's a prima facie self-defense case, taking all of the other contextual clues and cues out of it. And then we get into this reasonable belief and the fact that these citizen review boards are using terms like the possibility. You can't make a decision based on the possibility of a deadly threat. Well, we're not dealing with the possibility. We're dealing with a probability. A possibility is this. You could be walking down the street and hit with a piece of an aircraft that falls off of the airplane mid-flight and kills you. That's a possibility. Probability is based on clear and present articulable facts that surround the need for a deadly force tactic. And this is what is occurring in these incidents where there's a vehicle involved, a subject has made the decision that freedom is more important than the officer's lives or anyone else's life that's involved. And the officers are then respondent to that deadly threat. And they're applying a deadly force tactic. They're not making a deliberate decision to kill. There's two very different narratives that are associated with that. A deadly force tactic is a tactic used to save a life. That is completely skewed in the narrative that's perceived by a citizen review board. And those things have to be calculated into these, which Tisch did 100%, and so did the AG. They're looking at the reality, and they all said the struggle that ensued, the officer's position, the reasonable belief that someone was going to be substantially injured or killed was the catalyst for the deadly force tactic. And all of that is reasonable. And my hat's off to them for being educated, using terms like a split-second decision, looking at the video evidence as it in an objective and dispassionate review of the facts, not a passionate belief that something was done wrong based on the outcome. We have to take the outcome out of these. All things considered, moving up to the point that deadly force was used means that the deadly force was reasonable regardless of the outcome. There's just as high a probability that a subject may not have been killed in that event, but it would have changed behavior. And these are things that I think that Tisch took into consideration through an education and an understanding of critical police use of force decision-making under a split second time constraint, where the officers are making a decision that stings. It's not an easy decision that is made, but it has to be made. And that is the challenge of law enforcement. So, you know, tying all of those things together is what I call the common thread: perception, context, the officer's expectation based on reasonable beliefs, the decisions and actions that lead to a performance. All of those things have to be evaluated. And from what I can tell, in their evaluation, that common thread was closely adhered to, and they made a wise decision. These officers did what they had to do based on a reasonable belief that was supported by evidence that this individual placed them in harm's way.
Wow, you're on it. Hey, while you're there, do you have a copy of your book, that cool cover? I'd love to be able to say I designed the cover, but I had nothing to do with it. Look at that. Can you tell people about your book and how they can get a hold of it, Jamie?
Sure. Yeah, Anatomy of a Critical Incident, Navigating Controversy. It is literally written about this incident. And, you know, navigating controversy doesn't mean that controversy doesn't exist. It also doesn't mean that controversy is applicable, right? There's no controversy in this case. It's the narrative that creates the controversy. And that's what law enforcement has to learn to successfully navigate. Now, this doesn't mean that officers don't do the wrong thing at the wrong time for the wrong reason. But if we adhere to these specific protocols in the investigation and the review of these cases, those are more easily determined, and we can articulate our findings in those. I've had cases against cops where they didn't do the right thing and not for the right reasons, and it wasn't supported by the evidence. If we stick to these protocols, those 99% of the officers that do act in good faith, just as the chief said, the commissioner, then that is what it is. Having the fortitude to stand up against watchdog groups, interdepartmental judges that don't have experience in police work, don't like the way an outcome came to fruition, and make decisions based on that emotional conductivity is dangerous for law enforcement officers. Myself and my COO, Danny King, are in the process of developing the national stand down. And that simply means that we've got to take a pause and look at all of these components of these investigations that cause issue in law enforcement, where officers are being inappropriately charged, losing their freedoms. Departments are reaching deep into that financial well to write nuclear checks for events where the departments have assumed responsibility for things that just didn't happen. And it's a very important component of what we're talking about in law enforcement and the current climate that we work under.
Wow. Well, thank you. Hey, gentlemen, I want to jump over because we're getting low on time. We had that other New York article, but at newyork.formdaily.com, New York lowers the minimum age for police service, eliminating an exam fee as well. So the exam fee is only $40, but it looks like they're waiving it for July through September. No big deal. But here's the deal on the minimum age. They've lowered it down to 20 and a half years old in order to become a cop. The first change in 25 years. So the minimum age, it's only been adjusted twice in the last 30 years. So in 1995, it was raised from 20 years old to 22. And then in 2000, they lowered it back. They lowered it down to 21. Now it's at 20 and a half, but it's a 6-month academy. They did that so that they know they'll be at least 21 years old by the time they graduate. It does say, here's a quote from our commissioner, Jessica Tisch, saying that we want the best and the brightest to join the NYPD. We're clearing the way for those who are dedicated to serving the city, said the commissioner. Now, we've only got a few seconds before we come up for our next commercial break. Chief Schultz?
I was 21 when I started wearing a uniform, and I was not an idiot, and perform fairly well. So it's a individual thing, a training thing, an ethics thing. I don't think that's going to be a killer.
Okay. All right. Good to know. We'll be right back, gentlemen. Stick with us. We got plenty more to come, including a story with a video component. We'll be right back. All right, guys. You know, as law enforcement officers, we deal with guns every day, but it's what we don't know about them that gets us in the trouble. Injuries, civil lawsuits, accidental discharges, misidentifications, lost prosecutions, and even disciplinary issues. But gunlearn.com, they have your back. You can quickly become extremely firearm knowledgeable by simply learning 14 training modules from the convenience of your home or your office, or by attending the live seminar at gunlearn.com. You can also become a safe, accurate, and competent certified firearm specialist like our very own Captain Brett Bartlett and also attorney Ken Affianco. Now, the course has had huge success in raising the bar of firearm knowledge, and GunLearn has been a trusted source since 2011 by gun manufacturers, federal agencies, forensic organizations, and police departments nationwide. Now, the founder, Dana Kelly, has come up with a unique opportunity. If you have your own agency, you can actually host a seminar for absolutely no cost. It's an amazing opportunity. Go to gunlearn.com to get more information. Again, that's gunlearn.com. Welcome back. Leo Roundtable at leoroundtable.com. My name is Chip DeBlock, your host. We're joined by Chief Joel Schultz and Sergeant Jamie Borden with Critical Incident Review. We just got done talking about NYPD lowering the hiring standards to 20 and a half years old. It's a 6-month academy. You'll be 21 by the time you graduate. Dr. Schultz has already weighed in. Sergeant Jamie, did you have anything on this one?
Sure, a little bit. Yeah. And I think the problem comes in, and Chief, you said it, you took the job when you were 21. A lot of officers back in the times that we were on patrol took the job. I worked with a lot of officers that were 21, 22 years old. And one of the key statements you made is that you weren't an idiot. And that runs into a problem because the climate of and this is not a dig at our new generation. They do amazing things. They've got amazing capabilities with resources that we barely understand today. I can barely get my computer to present a screen to be on this podcast. And, you know, but the problem is that communication skills and life experience is very different for our younger people in law enforcement. And lowering the age, I was always a firm believer that they should raise the age to 25 to create more life experience, because we've got a 21-year-old officer telling a 45-year-old man in a domestic violence that he understands. Well, that guy is not going to buy into that. And we run into communication issues. We run into disparities between, you know, that immense age gap where experience is prevalent in decision making and conversation, and communication is one of the biggest problems we have, which is tied directly into de-escalation training as it's posed as a tactic. And it's not. De-escalation is a goal. And these younger officers, what I'm seeing as an expert, are not the decision makers that officers were 25 years ago taking the job at the same age. And that's just my assessments as an expert in looking at cases where a 10-year, 9-year officer is on that's 35 years old, as opposed to a 21-year-old who hasn't had the need or the requirement to make life-based decisions, which guides their reasonableness in these incidents. So it's not necessarily a killer, but I think it's going to take an immense amount of training and experience building for those officers to be viable and successful, efficient decision makers in the field in today's climate, because that's also different than it was 25 years ago. People respected us when we were 21 years old on the street. They don't today. They don't respect law enforcement, period, for the most part, and especially in the things that go, you know, viral through social media. And we see it day in and day out.
You know, and I'll just comment that one advantage that I had being old school, and I mean old school, like 45 years ago, was that I was actually, after my 3-week field training, right? Then I was solo patrol. And it was 6 months before I went to the actual police academy, which in Missouri was another 3 weeks. So highly trained young officer. But I had context when I went to the police academy. So, right. So much academic training that's in the academy now is abstract to any officer, regardless of their age, until they get out there. And as I've complained before, training is siloed. Oh, let's do car stops. Let's do constitutional law. Let's do de-escalation. Let's do search and seizure. And then it's up to the officer to coalesce all those things when they get out in the street. So that obviously the training and indoctrination is another issue. I'm sorry to cut you off, Chip. Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say I started my career at 21. You know, I was fresh out of college, 4 years, you know, and I had my degree and started off in police work at the age of 21. That's young. And look, it's a... you need a good mentor system. We kind of view it as a 10-year apprenticeship with Tampa Police. You know, you kind of, if you stay as an officer and never get promoted, you get like step increases every year for 10 years because it's like an apprenticeship and you learn your job as you go. And I'm talking about just as you go through the academy or you go through in-service training or you go through an FTO program, you are years on the job before you're really competent at the level where you really need to be. I remember someone coming to me and wanted me to become an FTO when I had less than 3 years on. I thought that was just ridiculous. I thought that was just stupid. You know, I'm still learning so much. You don't need to put a guy like me. Look, I was a competent officer. I was a good cop, but I knew I was at least smart enough to know there was a lot I didn't know. And I was still learning way too much to be put in charge of training a newbie. Right. So yeah, you need your seasoned officers to be your FTOs. But there's so much to learn. There's just, I did so much growing up. You're forced to grow up extremely quick.
Chip, things don't, one of the most important things I think is that experience component, policy, training, and silos, especially nothing congeals until that officer is involved in that critical incident where now all these things apply that they've only read and been exposed to. They haven't had the opportunity to put it to the test. So when that congeals in that critical moment, right? That's where the rubber meets the road and that's where mistakes are made. And we can't expect officers to be perfect in those scenarios because they understand the policy doesn't mean that they know how it works in the field. And that's an important component.
All right. We only got 3 minutes. So here we go. Rumble.com. This is Butter, our favorite channel. Body cam video shows a stabbing suspect charging at an officer with a dagger before he ends up being fatally shot.
You got blood on this door?
Yep.
Can someone come first?
We're in Daytona Beach, Florida, so in my neck of the woods. Body cam video released on Monday shows the intense moments. An officer opened fire and kills an 18-year-old stabbing suspect who charged an officer with a knife, and this is according to the Volusia County Sheriff's Office. Now, deputies respond on Saturday night to it's near Daytona Beach, and there's a 16-year-old boy and a 39-year-old man. They've both been stabbed multiple times. There's a lot of blood. Volusia County Sheriff Mike Chitwood is given a play-by-play in a press conference, and he goes on to say that based on everything that they're hearing, there are multiple calls, multiple stabbing victims, and there's a possibility that there's more victims inside of a home, and the bad guy might be in the home as well. So it goes on to say that there's a deputy response to a residence where one of the stabbing victims is outside the home, and the deputy's trying to calm the guy down. You're not bleeding that bad. And the guy says, dude, I've lost a lot of blood. And the guy was covered, right? Yeah. And then the video jumps to another one. They're outside of a home. The suspect ends up being inside. They're commanding the guy to come out of the house. Video shows the officers preparing to enter the home, and then this guy jumps out of a bedroom door, it looks like, and the bad guy's name is Landon Watson. He's screaming at a Daytona Beach sergeant, charging him with a dagger, and it gets maybe within a millimeter of him, according to the sheriff, and he may have even struck him, the sheriff said. And they end up neutralizing the guy, and he ends up watching his 18 years old, and they kill him. And the sheriff is backing everybody 101%. We got 2 minutes to talk about this one. There's a lot to go over. Sergeant Jamie.
Yeah. So the argument's going to be that they failed to de-escalate, and they failed verbal commands. I look at it from the aftermath component that these officers were facing. They didn't stand down, surround the house, call in additional resources, all these other things that are going to come up, because that will go to a lawsuit, and they're just going to get a check written to make it go away. But those will be the arguments. There's no time for that. They didn't wait because there's other people in the house, and they know that. There's other people in the room with him when he comes out with that dagger. And literally on the video, you can't see anything that you just described. All you can see is a blur of movement in a low-lit environment where a video is capturing what it captures in the form of light data, not the experience the officers had. And all of those things have to be perpetually identified one step at a time in that micro timeline to really definitively defend the officers. And here's the problem. It appears clear cut to those of us that have the experience. It's not clear cut for anyone else outside of law enforcement. It has to be explained. Don't think because you've got it on video and that you understand it, that anyone else does. Do your diligence on those investigations. Don't drop the ball because it's a clean shoot. There's no such thing. These days, it will end up being identified as clean and through a full objective review and analysis, but don't drop the ball on that investigation because you think it's right.
Wow. Thank you, Dr. Schultz. Any final words before we,
just several of these video things we've seen over the last few weeks are people jumping out of doors armed and charging like many ambush things. And it's just terrifying. It's the stuff of, video games. Boy, it's hard to judge any officer dealing with that kind of horrific scenario.
Well, thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. And Chief Schultz, don't you have a book handy that you can show our audience?
$15 daily reading inspiration. Buy one for your squad room, for your cop relative, SchultzCo@gmail.com. I'll sign it and pay the postage.
But you'll sign it and pay the shipping as well?
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
You're right. Killing me, Chief.
SchultzCo@gmail.com. All right, another fantastic show. Thank you to Chief Joel Schultz and to Sergeant Jamie Border with a critical incident review. Guys, I usually take this opportunity to talk about the Wounded Blue at thewoundedblue.org, Lieutenant Randy Sutton's 501c3. It's helping cops out in the world of hurt. And, they're doing God's work, and they have a summit coming up as well. Jamie talked about that earlier. I support them on a monthly basis, and I know that they're not going to embarrass me, which is a real important thing. So please remember the Wounded Blue at thewoundedblue.org. Look, a shout out to our sponsors, guys. Gauls, our title sponsor, ComplianceTechnologies.com, Gauls.com, like I said, GunLearn.com, BlueTheGold.com, MyMedicare.life, SafeWare Recruiting, and Two Bells. Thanks. We'll look for you guys back tomorrow, 12 noon Eastern.